beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. As you may know, two activities are very dear to the hearts of Sufis, and they are prayer and poetry. And this afternoon, I have an opportunity to speak about both of them and show how they are interrelated. Prayer is a practice that is foundational on the Sufi path. Prayer is called by the Sufis the Mi'raj al-Ashiqeen, the ascension of lovers. It is the means by which the lover rises up into the presence of the beloved. Prayer is the conversation between the creature and the creator, a dialogue that is eternal and that ultimately absorbs all other words. All conversations are like tributaries that flow into this one ocean. The ocean of communion, the never-ending dialogue between the worshipper and the worshipped. And prayer has many forms. Sufism is an essence and not a form, but Sufism makes use of many forms. Each divinely revealed religious tradition has its distinct form of prayer, its ritual of prayer. And ritual prayer is of great benefit to the seeker. To enter into a routine of practice so that at a certain time, in a certain place, each day, one turns back to what is most important. That is something very necessary. In our heart of hearts, we know that our relationship with reality is of the essence. It is what is most important. And yet we are so preoccupied with what seems urgent that we never get to what is important. And so it is very necessary to build into one's routine times for prayer, contemplation, meditation. You might just think about how many not so significant activities one has committed oneself to and has routinely engaged in, and then consider the activity that is of the essence. How much room have you made in your life for it? If you look at the layout of your house, what does your prayer niche look like versus your TV room, which is larger and which is more carefully laid out? So when we consider what is most important in our lives, then we rebuild our lives to orient toward that purpose. And prayer becomes then a basic foundation, finding the time. We all say that we just don't have enough time. But if we look at how much time we spend in negligible activities throughout the day, we would realize we can make the time, and we must make the time for what is most important, to commune in the silence with reality. There's nothing more important. And if one does so, then one finds a certain time of day in a certain place. And if you sit there at first, of course, perhaps you're distracted and feeling all kinds of excuses, pretexts arising to take you away from the act itself. But if you persevere, if you give your full presence to it, it can't be done half-heartedly. It's a waste of time. But if you bring your full presence to it, you'll find that the experience deepens, transforms, and that each time you go back to that same place to perform your prayer is deeper. You're building up a magnetism. Every time that you perform that prayer in the same place, at the same time. The Sufis explain this by saying that when a person is praying, if an angel is passing by, flying overhead, and they notice a person in an act of prayer, they take note of it, and they'll come back the next day at the same time. And if you're there, they'll take a note of that and be sure to come back each day at that time. Of course, if you're not there at that time, they'll lose interest. And in this way, one after another, unseen being becomes attracted. And soon you find yourself praying, not alone, but in the company of beings of light. What seemed at first an isolated, private prayer has become a congregational prayer. So ritual prayer has been taught in all of the great religious traditions as a way of finding the center in a life that is decentered, returning to remembrance. And of course, the more often that one can return to that remembrance, so much the benefit. Because if one only once in the morning practices a prayer and meditation, and for the rest of the day lives a profane life, you're splitting yourself into two. And the essence of the spiritual path is unification, integration, that one's prayer spills out into life. And this is the effect of a prayer routine that's kept up faithfully, is that the awakened emotions of the prayer begin to percolate throughout one's life and spontaneously arise at all times, unexpectedly even. Which leads us to the second variety of prayer. The first being formal ritual prayer, which is determined by one's sacred tradition. But the other is spontaneous prayer. The spontaneous prayer of the heart that can rise up at any time. In fact, for the realized human being, every moment is a moment of prayer. That spontaneous prayer is not something different from what we ordinarily experience in our lives, except that it is an intensification of our intentions. It's not something that is superimposed on your daily life. It is the fulfillment of your daily life. So, for example, if you are walking downtown and you see an ambulance go by with its sirens blaring, well, you might be so caught up in the storm in your teacup that you don't pay it any attention at all. You're so concerned with your own little purview, But perhaps you do notice. Perhaps you look toward the ambulance, and perhaps you even spare a thought for the one who is in danger, the one who has been hurt. That is a further extension of a natural response. The first response is just to notice cognitively. The second response is an emotional response of sympathy. And you might think, I sympathize, I feel for the person who's in the ambulance because I myself know from experience what it can be like. But that's still not yet the fulfillment of the prayer. But if you further extend that thought, and not only sympathize, but send your love to the person who is in the ambulance, if you send your wish of goodwill, then you have taken a spontaneous natural reaction and given it life, given it power. You've sent it with keen intention. And then your thought grows wings and becomes an angel. Because our thoughts are angels. We are constantly emanating microorganisms, animalcules, muwakkals they are called in Sufism, that are, just as we are the microorganisms that are the substance of the angel of the earth, Isfandarmuz, as she is known among the Sufis. In the same way, each of us is an ecology of being producing innumerable beings that are angels and that we send out into the world. We generally do so haphazardly, without intentionality, and without our highest aspirations engaged. But when our highest, purest intentions are involved, we are no longer polluting the atmosphere with random negative judgments, cynicism, but we are actively sending out into the world angelic forces that ripple out and pervade this manifestation and fulfill a purpose beyond what we can ever possibly perceive. That is our legacy in this world. If you consider your family line, your lineage, you might be able to trace back your predecessors 3 or 4, 5 generations. If you're an avid genealogist, probably much further. But what can be known about the substance of the lives of one's predecessors? You might have an old black and white photograph of your great-grandparent. But that person, your predecessor, has become dust in the ground. All of the events of that person's life are almost completely forgotten. And yet that person remains actual and effectual in the world through this legacy, the legacy of the prayers, of the active willpower as it is projected through the awakened heart. That being continues to live, and it is through these awakened hearts that all perfection and fulfillment manifests in this creation. So every moment is a moment for spontaneous remembrance, prayer, glorification. And now let us consider the aspects of prayer. The first aspect is gratitude. Appreciation. Prayer as an expression of thanks. We are coming up on a very wonderful American holiday, Thanksgiving, a time when, for once in the year, we can consciously count our blessings instead of enumerating our grudges and complaints, as we have a tendency to do. Just think of how much effort and energy is spent thinking endlessly about what is wrong in other people, in the world, in ourselves. And consequently, how little of our attention is available to remember what is good in our experience. And there is a great deal that is good if we would only remember. The problem is we only remember what is good when it is gone. You don't appreciate what you have until it is lost. When a friend, a beloved family member perishes, how intensely we feel the meaningfulness of our relationship with that person. But did we feel it so strongly in life? Or when we have lost a faculty of perception, losing one's vision or one's hearing, one realizes what a gift it is. Or a limb of the body. Every particle of our being that we have been given in our life's experience is not our own. We haven't earned it. We haven't purchased it. It has been freely given out of infinite compassion and love. And yet we just take it for granted. We are a guest enjoying incredible hospitality. But we only remember the blessings when something is taken from us. And if we have not been present to that blessing in our life, when it is gone, it is gone. And it is as if it never existed. But when we are present to the blessings of life, through gratitude, through thanksgiving, nothing can ever be lost. Because our very act of gratitude, our act of appreciation, renders people, things, eternal in our heart. That's the difference between ephemerality and eternity. Gratitude. So it's through gratitude that the substance of this world of Maya, this world of illusion, which is in fact non-existent, is made existent. Gratitude is the act of witnessing with clear presence, feeling deeply, fully, experiencing, and thereby actually transforming and resurrecting the substance of the planet. All that has not been transubstantiated through gratitude dissolves into nothingness and is lost. And all that is taken up in gratitude is raised into eternity. It becomes the condition of the divine heart. So we have incarnated. We have been born for thankfulness. We have been born to experience life with transparent presence. And that all that we take into our heart through our experience is actualized in the divine reality. This is how creation works. It doesn't work merely through the laws of physics. It works through the alchemy of the heart. The world is not created of matter. Matter is an illusion. Matter is a prop for gratitude. So this is an opportunity to read the first poem. There's one poem for each of the aspects of prayer. And these are. And this first one is a poem from my own grandfather, Hazrat Inayat Khan. Thanks be to God. The very world that birthed us is now bathed by wondrous nature in a rapture of her glorious light. The splendor of earth, air, fire, water, now revealed, and humankind, highest of creatures, endowed with intellect's might, so that all the beasts, winged and hoofed, are placed under his command, and Adam's veins are filled with art, science, faith. He knows the sciences are clear, but music is the weightiest. As a surging ocean outweighs the very world through which it flows. If he whose heart's been moved by the science of music's whole effect were offered the pleasure of emperorship, he'd certainly ignore it. For man is not alone in his delight at that sweet sound. Since even animals have sacrificed themselves for it. More stubborn than a donkey, he who holds that music's impure. Ignorant of beauty, how claim acquaintance with the Lord? Creator, the ocean surges. Permit my skiff to reach the shore. King, I beg what kindness, Inayat, thou canst afford. Now the next aspect of prayer is repentance. We might ask ourselves, why are we so habitually unappreciative of the blessings of life? Where is our attention, if not in the beauty that manifests itself all around us and within us? And the answer is that we are in a state of anxiety, a state of inner disturbance and fear and guilt, suffering, that we have found ourselves more and more entangled in karmic ties that chafe and bind. And that what began as a simple mistake snowballed and developed and has taken over our lives so that we are roiled in fear and pain. And we spend enormous amounts of energy denying, attempting to repress, suppress our awareness of the error of our ways, of our mistakes. We spend enormous amounts of inner resource closing the hidden recesses of our minds for fear of what we might find there. The ego, by definition, refuses to accept responsibility, asserts its own infallibility, and blames everyone else for any error that it might notice. But all of us are human beings, creatures of limitation, who make mistakes. And so the ego must repress the mistakes, the errors, the limitations of our life. And these impressions go deep down and become a cover over the soul. And so it is that the ego maintains a profile of perfection, while the soul that is perfection itself, the soul that is pure luminous essence without any limitation, becomes covered over with gloom. Our light is hidden under a bushel, and one lives in a state of fear that one's true personality will be uncovered. And so one keeps one's head down, and thereby one is prevented from fulfilling one's purpose in life. One is destined to act confidently in the realization of one's life purpose. But this is impossible in the awareness of guilt. So to recover our true purpose, the ego has to reclaim its responsibility to liberate the soul from the guilt that it has taken on. And so when the ego acknowledges its mistake, what began as a simple mistake always leads to greater and greater complexity and suffering, as Shakespeare said. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. So on the mystic path, the time comes when the ego is asked to take responsibility, to accept its shortcomings, to accept its ignorance, to respect that its perspective will always be one perspective among many with blind spots. And when the ego, in an act of humility, does this, accepts responsibility, makes an effort to make amends, understands the suffering that is caused to another person, and tries to make things right with that person, and seeks the forgiveness of its creator, something magical happens. All of that darkness that covered the soul evaporates, and the light of the soul shines out with its original innocence and purity and power. It took only this small act of the soul, of the ego accepting its own responsibility. And one sees that it's not so painful after all. So that is repentance, and in repenting, an incredible alchemy takes place, because the divine nature, in essence, is mercy and compassion. Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. But that compassion needs an object. And so it is that when we become aware of our limitation, our shortcoming, and put that shortcoming up into the view of the Creator, the divine nature can express itself in a way that is otherwise impossible. The whole of the creation exists that mercy, that tender, sweet grace of forgiveness can flow. And our sin, our error, our limitation is the opportunity for the floodgates of that mercy to be opened. It only takes an act of contrition, an act of repentance on our part to open that mercy so that God can become who God is in actualization. We can see this around us in our own lives, that although we may deeply regret the tragedies that humanity and that other creatures suffer on earth, to witness an act of true compassion of one limited being sympathizing, deeply resonating with the experience of another being and selflessly giving support, that is a cosmic triumph. It is the very purpose of existence. And that within that context, limitation itself can be understood. It is the accommodation in which pure mercy can flow. And it just requires our act of turning back to the source, accepting responsibility, letting the pure and innocent light of the soul shine forth. So let me read another poem, Toba, Repentance. This is from a Qalandar. Qalandar is a kind of Sufi, a very ecstatic, antinomian mystic, the kind of dervish who constantly travels with a beggar's bowl and an axe and has no outer ties in the world and manifests the divine power, the divine Jalal very strongly. This Qalandar was named Bu Ali Shah Qalandar. And this is from his Masnavi. Once upon a time, a perfect Gnostic's heart lane was blocked to imagination's traffic. In the land of his heart, each day was fasting day. Forgetfulness was a word he blushed to say. For years he'd prayed without taint of hypocrisy. Nothing passed his heart but remembrance of he. So many decades went by in this way, till a thought broke in on his perfect bliss one day. To wit, no one's as perfect now as me. I keep my heart under tight security. I've vanquished all desire, all greed and lust, and vain attachments are to me but dust. The moment the man of God conceived these words, a voice came to his ear. It seemed he heard. The very instant you glanced at yourself in pride, you fell, and a veil fell on your face and hides your glance as well. And until the veil shall fall, How will you find and pass through heaven's wall? At once the Sheikh felt ashamed of his secret session. In distress, he repented his fleeting mental transgression. Anew, he sealed his covenant with God to sacrifice himself on the path he trod. So polish your heart's mirror of all mist, that its inner reflection shines and can't be missed. O pursuer of ruses, all that your heart may crave, in its need is supplied by the self, its slave. One night of purity, attain that art. One night of purity, attain that art, and 100 thoughts won't agitate your heart. Let this design take hold of you, hold sway, until you come to know the just true way. The ego versus justice and equity. The winner takes the heart as property. O God, give me an ear that really sees, and fill my head with love's melancholic lees. Strike a fire like Mount Sinai in my breast. Let flame erupt, let darkness be recessed. Years of desire for you, that's been my creed. How could you fail to recognize my need? The tongue of the unseen speaks. Stop the press. No one leaves your door in hopelessness. Whoso appears a supplicant at your door, how could he ever be sent away still poor? Who begs in hopeful spirit at your gates will find the longed-for one in his embrace. I invoke the name of Mustafa, O Lord, and the family of the Prophet, their honor, their word, and the four friends. Forgive on Judgment Day my wretched deeds, only for this I pray. On Resurrection Day, with the family's intercession, that my plea will be heard and my confession.